set in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. How would you like a Rembrandt? What about a Renoir? Would an imposing old master in a magnificent frame enhance your living room and your status? What? You can't afford millions of dollars for old paint? Don't worry. There are genuine fakes that will fool the neighbors and only cost you a few thousand. In elegant homes around the world, fake masterpieces are hanging on the walls. And they're all perfectly legal, that is, as long as they're identified as copies. But what if they're so good they can pass as the real thing? There are a lot of those making their way into the art market too, but they're not fakes, they're forgeries, and the price of that is jail. But what about our copies? Can we say there's art on our walls? And should art galleries strapped for cash or worried about theft put genuine fakes in the frames? The master fakers say our best love images are like our favorite songs. New artists just keep interpreting them. Connection listeners, is there art in faking art? What matters more, craftsmanship or originality? Today we talk to a British master forger. He almost got away with what's known as the biggest art fraud of the 20th century. But he spent time in jail, and now even the police want to buy his fakes, as long as they're clearly labelled genuine, genuine fakes. Our number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Well, we are a real, genuine programme, the real thing on The Connection, but we want to talk to a man who made a lot of money passing off copies as the real thing. On the line from Staffordshire, England, is John Myatt. Once upon a time, his forged paintings fetched millions on the art market in the 80s and 90s. He's out of jail. I'm told he's become a bit of a cult figure. John Myatt, welcome to The Connection.
Thank you very much.
Tell us what you used to do before you went to jail.
I was an art teacher for quite a long time. A musician, and I started painting fake paintings when the head of my company, the boss of my company, which was I think it was affiliated to CBS in over in America, he'd been to dinner with someone extremely rich, and they had got a couple of paintings by Raoul Dufy on their wall, and he was just saying, "Oh, I could never afford a couple of paintings like that," and I said, "Well, actually, I'll do you a couple of Raoul Dufys." And it sort of gave me the idea that I could make a living doing that.
Is it that easy to copy the greats?
Well, they weren't copies. They were. I was what you really need, of course, if you is hands on. You really need the original right in front of you. But that's not always possible. So I just read as much as I could, got as many books as I could about him. They were tailor made to fit in a particular house in Richmond, in London, where he was. So they were probably much bigger than the originals. I remember he paid me £250 for the paintings, and he spent £800 each on the frames, just to make them look, you know, really imposing.
That was
how I got started.
And once you got started, in the end, you what, forged 200 copies, 200 old masters?
What happened? It was a kind of... I became a single parent. I had two little babies to take care of. And that really meant working from home and being there all the time. And I put an advert in the back of the magazine saying genuine fakes, 19th and 20th century paintings, and left my phone number, as it were. And that meant that I could stay at home, take care of the kids who were, she was two and he was just, she was three and he was 18 months old. And, you know, I could be there. And the work started coming in, and it did so well that I was able to get someone to come and help me with the children as well. And one of the people, one of my customers, he just kept on coming back and back, more and more paintings, until by the time he got to about the 10th painting, he'd sort of run out of ideas and said, "Well, John, what would you like to do next?" And I said, "Well, if you don't mind, I'd quite like to do a little small little cubist painting. I'll make it up. I'll just sort of imagine it." And I got an elliptical piece of board about 12 inches by about 6 inches, and I made up a cubist painting, and he took it back home, and he did a lovely job framing it up. And about a month later, he called me up and said, "Look, you remember that little cubist painting you did? I've just taken it into, I can't remember whether it was Christie's or Sotheby's, and they valued it at £26,000. Which is a lot of money. How would you like to have half of that, you know?" And
but it was your signature on that? It was said to be your art?
No, it wasn't at all. No, it was.
So whose signature was on it? Who did you say it was?
The man's name, he was a German painter. His name was Gleize, G-L-E-I-Z-E-S. And I painted it. I put his signature on the front, Albert Gleize. I painted the thing in emulsion paint. I mean, it was painted in just ordinary house paint. But, of course, it was behind glass, so they couldn't see it. And he'd used kind of old, sort of, he'd aged it, distressed it. So as you looked around the back of the thing, there was all kind of rusty little nails and all that. He just enjoyed himself having fun and just, you know, said, well, I wonder what would happen if I took this in, you know.
So you were straying away from genuine fakes into forgeries there. Did you start to feel a bit guilty?
Yes, I did, obviously. I had no part of the selling of the actual paint, the contact with any of the galleries or the auction houses. But after a while, I did become very frightened. I thought, you know, I've made a hell of a mistake here. How am I going to get out of it? You know, but unfortunately for me, it took me about 4 or 5 years before I suddenly realized I'd dug a big hole for myself.
Well, tell us, when were you caught? How were you caught? The police caught up with you.
Well, this business partner, if you like, your partner in crime, if you like, his marriage fell apart, and he moved out of the house, and his wife found a whole lot of papers and documents and things relating to what he and I had been doing together, and she bundled it all up and she took them to the police, and the police sort of weren't very interested at first, but I think eventually, from what they've told me since, one of them said, well, someone's got to do all this stuff, and they realized as they slowly worked their way through a mass of paperwork that this was actually quite a big criminal conspiracy.
So you spent time in jail, and he spent even more time in jail. But tell us, I was reading that when you got out of jail, you swore to turn over a new leaf, you'd never do this again, and one of the first persons to come up to you was the policeman who arrested you and said, would you mind doing me a bit of that painting you used to do before?
That's absolutely true. That's quite true. And I'd sort of come to the conclusion that painting was just nothing but trouble. I didn't want anything more to do with it. And my arresting officer, who's now retired from the Arts and Antiques Squad at Scotland Yard, said, you know, you really are stupid if you're going to stop doing this. And they'd been very nice, actually. They'd sent me, the police had sort of sent art materials into prison for me. They were just, I like them a lot, actually. The British police are really rather good in some respects. And he said, you know, you've just got to, I can get you some more commissions if you'd like. So it's fair enough. And then the barristers who'd run the case said, you know, well, they'd like a little memento of the case. Would you do a little fake for them? And I thought, well, these barristers, they, you know, lawyers, they earn so much money that surely they could afford, you know, whatever, slightly more than I was used to charging, perhaps about, you know, £700 or £800 or, you know, getting on for £1,000 or something.
Yeah, zeros.
And I suddenly realized, you know, here was a good business.
Good way to make money. And it's legal.
A way to make money.
And
yeah,
legally.
And completely legal. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you get a whole lot of Boston. You're in Boston, aren't you?
Indeed, I mean, well, you're in Boston too.
television, become American, Russian, Mexican, all these people just, you know, want to talk to you. And I sometimes wonder why.
Why? They obviously like it, but is it really a good thing? John, I do stay on the line. We're going to bring in some guests that have been with me listening to you all the while. Alan Chong is curator of the collection at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum here in Boston, celebrating its centennial this year. Welcome, Alan. And also by Frederick Ilkman. He's an assistant curator of European art at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. He's also the organizing curator of the current Thomas Gainsborough exhibition. Welcome, Frederick.
Hello.
To you, Alan Chong, you've been making some very interesting facial expressions the whole time John was speaking. John's being told by upright members of society, barristers and police, and you're stupid not to continue doing it. Do they have a point? The people love it.
I think people love fakes. We love the idea of copies and fakes and forgeries. I think there's nothing better than the feeling of delight of fooling experts. And I'm struck by the tale I've just heard, how familiar it is. Actually, it's a centuries-old tale, one of a charming person, of a innocent young talent somehow abused by commercial middlemen who lead him or she into crime. It's a story I could repeat 100 times, and I've been collecting these stories. Hans von Mecheren, the great Vermeer forger in the early part of this century, had almost exactly the same tale to make. He was just emulating Vermeer, trying to do his own thing, and it was evil dealers who somehow, you know, took his work and sold them as fake Vermeers for, you know, thousands of what would then be, by today's standards, millions of dollars. And it's something that's repeated over and over again to the extent that I begin to wonder how much of it is true. I mean, how much is a talent who is able to copy paintings innocent?
But he's fooled so many people, and he didn't get caught for a very long time.
Right, but how much is a copyist in collusion with the person selling the work of art?
Well, that's the morality of it. What about the art of it?
Well, I haven't seen the things myself, and I almost think that it needs to be judged on a case-by-case basis. Is it something that copies explicitly another work of art? Is it a variation? Is it an intelligent variation? Because obviously the idea of making copies is something that has been with us for centuries. It is a way artists simply learned to paint or to sculpt in the Renaissance and Baroque.
Well, let's talk about copies. And Frederick Ilchman, I have to come clean with you. One of the reasons why we wanted you in is one of my colleagues here at The Connection went to your Thomas Gainsborough exhibition at the museum and went to see one of her favourite paintings, The Blue Boy, and there was a sign saying, a copy. You don't have a problem hanging copies in your museum, obviously.
Well, as Alan said a minute ago, for centuries artists learned to make art by copying other works. That was the sort of way you did it. And also, just like people have today framed posters, or in some cases John Myatt's, what you do is you would have a copy of a work you wanted but couldn't own because the original already existed. Now, in the case...
You're a gallery.
Right. We're a very large museum with a public responsibility and an educational mission. And in this case, one of the most celebrated and renowned Gainsborough paintings is one called The Blue Boy. And it's owned by the Huntington Library in California, and they never lend that picture. But The Blue Boy is important not just as an icon of Gainsborough, but also it's a very interesting example of Van Dyck dress. In the mid-1700s, there was a real vogue in Britain for dressing up in the style of the 1630s. And not only is it an example of that Van Dyck dress, but this painting, The Blue Boy, is very important because Van Dyck was the major influence on Gainsborough. It's kind of hard to imagine for us, but his great influence as a portraitist was someone who lived more than a century before. And so the point in this is that not to have The Blue Boy, or a version of The Blue Boy, is to sell Gainsborough short, in a sense. And that's what we have. We have not any copy, but a very interesting one, one made by John Hoppner, who was an important British portraitist the generation after Gainsborough. And Hoppner, in fact, owned the original Blue Boy for a while, and this is the same dimensions as The Blue Boy. And it's next to, in the gallery, in a big gallery of very ambitious full-length portraits, it's next to a Gainsborough's own copy of a Van Dyck. And so you can see that Gainsborough copying Van Dyck, and here's Hoppner copying Gainsborough, copying Van Dyck.
Back to our same question. You said it was a very interesting copy. We'll have to see what interesting really means when you're in the art world. Now we're discussing the art of faking it. Is there any art? What is art? Is it originality or is it craftsmanship? Join us here on Connection. Our number, 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Lise Doucette. Today we're talking about fine and not so fine art. You're listening to The Connection. Today we're talking about fakes and forgeries. On the line from England is a once master forger, John Myatt. He won millions on the art market for his copies in the 80s and 90s. He spent time in jail and now he's just doing genuine fakes. And with me here in the studio, Alan Chong, curator of the collection at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, and Frederick Ilchman, assistant curator of European art at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Frederick Ilchman, let me go back to you to answer this question of yes or no. Would you obviously have hung a copy in your museum, but was there discomfort about it?
Well, initially, a number of people, my colleagues, said, make sure this is very clear. And of course, that's the main thing. The reason that a copy could be a forgery is if it has the intention to deceive. Our label's very clear. It says, Thomas Hoppner after Thomas, John Hoppner after Thomas Gainsborough. Make it very clear, we even have a reproduction in black and white on the label of the original Gainsborough. Another thing we did was just psychological, is not put that painting on the first wall you see in the exhibition gallery where it hangs. Gainsborough's Blue Boy is his most famous picture, and it would be quite misleading for someone to spy that across, you know, from the doorway and say, wow, Blue Boy's here. And although I'm sure a large percentage of the visitors have been mistaken for a moment, that thinking that was originally that, and then this is the whole question about what we say with a label.
Has to be honest label. Let me bring in Alan Chong here. Alan, would you hang a copy or a sign saying this is a copy in your gallery?
It depends. It depends on the context and the way it's framed, the way it's put in context for the public.
But in principle, there's not a problem.
There are certain examples where I can imagine doing a show of copies, the show of artistic response from one generation to another. For example, Rembrandt or Rubens, these great painters from the 17th century, were always looking backwards in time to their predecessors, to Raphael, to Michelangelo, and they made beautiful copies, adding a lot of their own interest and inspiration to what they produced. But that's a very different thing, because we're dealing with a particular period, with a particular intellectual and artistic response to another work of art.
Indeed, because galleries used to pride themselves on what was in their collection,
right,
or whether they could get access to something. So obviously you didn't get the Blue Boy, as you say, one of the most famous paintings of Gainsborough. So shouldn't you just admit it? We didn't do it this time for you. Does the fact that you can put in copies then devalue, Alan Chong, the value of the masters?
It can.
You're going to do a whole exhibition of copies, you said.
You could, if you made it and build it as one artist responding to another. If you were to build an exhibition as a Rembrandt exhibition, and then you discovered that when you entered the show, the vast majority of works were copies, whether they were from the same time as Rembrandt or copies made yesterday, I think there would be a level of public disappointment. But I do want to stress that there's a very big difference between the tradition of copying in the time of the artist, the original being made, as opposed to something that was produced very recently. And I think that's the nature of the deception we're talking about. I would have great difficulty hanging a modern copy of an old master painting, simply because I think it's so misleading.
Well, let's bring in John Myatt here. John Myatt, would you ever hope to have an exhibition of your copies in some gallery?
I don't do copies, really, unless I'm more or less someone's twisting my arm. Bernard and Alan made some really good points, didn't they? It was just so interesting to listen to them. Since the 20th century painting is possibly where I sort of focus most of my attention, what your other two contributors are focusing on is art where there was a considerable amount of technical expertise and skill involved. What we call modern art is, in many ways, has turned its back on technique. And in fact, technique has almost become a dirty word. And here in Great Britain or United Kingdom or whatever we call it, we've got sort of state-sponsored art which is sets out to challenge all the kind of accepted technical norms, as it were, and in those circumstances where you just worry so much about the 21st century and what it's going to actually leave behind, it is almost an open invitation to people to fake paintings in a way, because artists themselves seem to have been heading down a blind alley, I suppose, since around about 1918. Now, that's a very broad statement, but I think what I'm trying to say is you have to make a special exception for 20th century painting. Something strange happened after the First World War to all of us, in a way, and that's probably, with a bit of luck, we're going to sort of turn back onto the way we ought to be. Just one other thing, I think it was Alan mentioned. I was thinking of Rubens while he was speaking, a lovely painting by Rubens called King Charles I on Horseback. Now, Rubens' studio turned out probably 8 or 9 of those, and we have experts in this country who sort of say, well, is Rubens' hand actually responsible for the horse's head, or did he do the portrait of Charles I on this one? They can't make their minds up. There's one in the Queen's Gallery in Buckingham Palace, one in Leningrad, I think, one in Warwick Castle. They're all over the place. In the time that these paintings were were produced, if the artists and the artist's studio, because he employed a whole lot of people, if they thought they had a hit on their hands, they did actually turn that painting out several times for obvious financial reasons.
John Myatt, you can paint the paintings and talk the talk. Do stay on the line. We're going to bring in one of our Connection listeners. David is on the line from Durham, North Carolina. David, what would you like to say about this art controversy?
Oh, I don't know about a controversy, but I think it's a delightful program. I'm sitting here doing a copy right now for a radiologist. I'm an artist who found me, I guess, about 5 years ago. And since then, pretty much, I go, well, there's my rent every month, as he brings back things from Europe and says, I want another portrait of a Habsburg emperor. I've, in fact, done a copy of the Rubens Charles for him. It's very interesting, and he asked for quirky little changes. It always works out. I really had nothing more to say than it's a delightful way to make a living. It allows you to do your regular art while you're doing this.
And is it art?
Is it art? No, I call it mimicry. but he's commissioned 15 of them, which is a lot of large portraits. So, I mean, if you want to know whether it's art or not, the main reason I was calling, there's a wonderful novel by Robertson Davies called Bread and the Bone.
Yes, Canadian novelist. Now dead. But yes.
So is it art? I think so.
Your skill, is there skill? Is there technique?
Oh, there's a lot of technique. When he first approached me, he said, I've been looking for an artist for about 10 years who could do what I want. And I wouldn't attest to my artistry, but I'd attest to my technique, certainly. So I just draw them up for him. I don't sign them Rubens, you know. I don't think it'd fly in North Carolina.
So it's all perfectly legal in case the police are also listening in to the connection. We'll let you get back to your copying, your mimicry, your art, David.
I'm doing a Klimt for him right now. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for listening to the program and for calling in. We're going to take another caller on the line from Essex, Massachusetts. Michael wants to join us. Michael, what would you like to say about this issue?
Yes, I'm very interested in this issue. I'm a fine art and antiques auctioneer in Essex, Massachusetts, and sell a lot of 19th century and 20th century paintings. And to my mind, of course, it isn't really art. It's actually very good technique and very good craftsmanship to copy these works. And the original composition and the original work is, of course, the art. So this really brings to the point that people mostly like to buy autographs. A lot of the Massachusetts painters of 100 years ago, minor works by them, maybe not done so well, can bring much more money than the works by lesser artists, less well-known artists. And I think that it's unfortunate that people need to have their own fake Rubens to feel okay with their neighbors.
So you still have people coming to you wanting to buy at a good price the big masters?
Well, of course, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's fine to copy these works, but in my own mind, of course, it's not art. It's very good craftsmanship.
Which also has a price? They pay big prices for good craftsmanship, good technique that still has a value?
Well, it does, but philosophically, in my mind, the creation of art is art, and it illustrates the point that people really want to, they need to feel okay with their, know they're buying the right art. The right art is some art that many people have said is important art. So then they're never free to pursue the lesser well-known people in any area of art. And those lesser well-known artists sometimes sell for a tenth or a twentieth of the big names. And to me, it would be much more interesting to buy an original lesser well-known art than a copy of The Blue Boy.
Michael, thank you very much for joining us on The Connection. Let's just look at this in a slightly different way. Alan Chong, some of the people who've defended the business of fakes and copies are saying, well, it's just like music. You know, the people, singers often take someone else's lyrics or they take their compositions and they interpret them in a different way. It's been done down through the centuries. Is there a parallel?
No, in my view, absolutely no parallel. Music and stage plays, poetry to a certain extent, was meant to be performed. It was written with the performer, with the interpreter, always in mind. A composer, Bach or Beethoven, always knew that there would be an intermediary, that there would be an additional creative force to this performance. That's not true of paintings. It's not true of historic sculpture, although there are one or two exceptions. I think some Renaissance sculptors knew that their work would be excerpted and reused in many ways, because there's already a tradition of reusing bits and pieces of things. But that's very much an exception. The act of copying can be an educational experience. It can be an it can add creative value, as it were. But in general, the precise mimicry of a work of art, in my opinion, I have to agree with the last couple of callers, it isn't really art. It's something else. It may not even be technically good. It depends on the individual creativity, the individual accomplishment of a particular copy.
Frederick Gilchin?
Well, we also could make a distinction between what's a good copy and also a copy made in good faith. Something that's important to remember, the painting stays the same. It just depends what label we attach to it. To get back to the Blue Boy copy for a minute, in the early 20th century, George Hearn, who owned this picture, claimed that this was the original Gainsborough and the Duke of Westminster had a copy. Now, of course, that's clearly wrong, but for a while people believed him, and part of it is because he was a famous New York collector who could attach a lot of importance to his label. And so in a way, the painting has always stayed the same, but for a while, as long as Hearn was maintaining this, you could call this a forgery rather than just a copy.
It's interesting, too, at the same time as copies are becoming more popular, the prices for originals in the art auctions are huge now. They're running into millions and millions of dollars.
Well, just a minute ago, one of the callers made a very good point that instead of supporting an artist working today or a lesser-known artist, someone would prefer to have a copy of a well-known painting. And part of that, you get some status, you get recognition. And in a way, this is what John Myatt said earlier, maybe there is a real discomfort that people have since around the time of the First World War. Art doesn't seem artful anymore. It's about originality, perhaps, rather than the craftsman aspect. And one thing about a copy is, you know, it's a handmade object done laboriously, perhaps over a lot of time, showing, we hope, a lot of reflection. And that, at least, is something we can measure. It's hard to measure the originality of an idea, but you can tell how many brushstrokes someone put on a canvas.
Well, let's bring in John Myatt, who's still on the line with us from Staffordshire, England. John, what went through your mind all those years? You made it clear that you had to do it for the money. We had another, David was telling us that he regards it as mimicry. How did you think of it?
I was inventing new paintings. I would look at Ben Nicholson. You might not have heard of him. He's a British painter from Cornwall. I would look at what he was doing in 1956. I would, as it were, try to get under his skin. I'd read about where he was, what he was doing, what his family was like, and what the size of his paintings. And I would just create a new one. And for me, I think it was Bernard just said, it is a massive learning curve. I tell you what, I find my own paintings, if you like. I find myself boring, and I find my own kind of rather sort of plodding, representational way of painting, which is my way of painting, I find it dull. And yet when I get the chance to be Georges Braque or Pablo Picasso or Claude Monet or Renoir, you know, I don't know what it is about it, but it's just sort of a very liberating thing for me. That's what makes it very enjoyable. You learn something, you have fun, you try and keep the kind of criminal aspect of it right at the back of your mind. I mean, I really did go into denial over that. I really did pretend it wasn't happening.
But let's be clear on this. You say that you didn't do copies, but did you not reproduce some of the masters? Because otherwise the art historians could catch you up. They could say...
No, I didn't reproduce anything. I didn't.
But they could say to you, but this artist was never known to have painted this painting. Wouldn't it have been easier to catch you?
No, you'd say it's been in a private collection since you know, for the last 40 or 50 years, which is why I was specifically talking about 20th century painting, incidentally. This painting has no track record because it's belonged to someone who bought it directly from the artist, and so on and so forth. And so then what you do is you take it into one of the sort of acknowledged experts in that area, or one of the auction houses in London who have experts in that particular artist. And if they give it the kind of imprimatur and they say, well, this is okay, then what would have been worth $200 could well be worth $200,000. And that was because they were new paintings, if you see them. Copying is, and both your contributors over there have said, copying is a degree of technical skill involved, and I really do quite agree. But when you're trying to come up with a new painting, I'll give you an example. I've just got a wonderful commission from a man in London, completed it, Georges Braque. He's got a most splendid, one of those lovely wedding cake houses in the West End of London. I did two paintings. One was a copy of Braque in 1910, And I looked at what Braque was doing in 1911, 1912, as he moved towards a rather more synthetic kind of cubism, and I just made one up. I framed them both the same size. I knew he'd take one and I'd keep the other. I said to him, which one would you prefer? And he prefers the one that's a totally new kind of creation, because I've had much more fun with that. And I think it shows in the painting. That's how I work. I can't. Your other contributor who called up, a nice chap from somewhere who was just painting. He'd done Charles I and all those others. I don't do that quite so well. I have got. Sometimes you'll get someone who says, "Can you do a Gainsborough? And can you change the face so that here's a photograph of my husband, and could you make it look like my husband?" And then, of course, they stick it up on the wall of the house, and they say, "Well, you know, this is a portrait of great Uncle Jasper, who fought the Spanish and the, you know, in the Battle of Hispaniola and all." And everybody has a laugh about it.
I don't think it would make it into the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston, but I have to bring in our guests here because they've had a variety of expressions, and we're all enjoying your comments, John. Alan Chong.
Well, you raise the issue here of the inventive forgery and these imaginative reconstructions of what an artist from the past might have made is, in fact, the area in the 20th century that have most deceived experts. The fake Vermeers that came out in the 1920s and 30s weren't copies. They were inventions, very, very clever, I would say almost genius-like inventions, that conformed to what art historians, what the experts wanted from a new Vermeer. Eric Hebborn, the great faker of drawings who died about 8 years ago, I suppose, invented new drawings supposedly by Raphael, by Tintoretto, by Fra Bartolomeo. They were totally new compositions that have apparently, or allegedly, fooled all the experts. And I think it's this invention of something that's based on another artist that seems to be inspired, where I think we're getting into a gray area of things that require more than skill. They require a psychological understanding of experts like us. And I think they're the most dangerous fakes of all.
Oh, my goodness. Art meets psychology. You're listening to The Connection. I'm Lise Doucette. We're talking about the art of faking it and what indeed is art. Join us here in the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. All you genuine fakers out there, put down your paintbrushes and call us here on The Connection. To set, and today we're connecting you to fakers, forgers, and fine artists. But which of their art is the finest of all? Join us here in the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Our two guests in the studio, Alan Chong, curator of the collection at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Also, Frederick Ilchman, he's assistant curator of European art at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And on the line all the way from Staffordshire, England, is John Mide, whose forged paintings once fetched millions on the art market in the 80s and 90s. Now he, after a little time in jail, he has a thriving business. Frederick Ilchman, let's bring you into the conversation.
Well, I wanted to just explore how things like a John Myatt forgery, a pastiche, an invented forgery, can be accepted as genuine. And the two big concerns here, the first thing is that the public should know that essential in determining the authenticity of a work is the work's provenance. That is, where is the history of ownership from the time it was made in the artist's studio till the time it arrives on someone's wall? And with many 20th century works, John Mide had a way around that, in that there isn't really a paper trail sometimes. It's often, there's no contract necessarily. It might just be on someone's wall or changes hands at a handshake with no invoice, let's say. But it's essential to have, one thing curators do is to study the provenance, to figure out what exhibition something's been at or the bills of sale. And in fact, his accomplice managed to forge documents and place them in libraries so he could say, well, just look, it was in a 1950 exhibition. The other point besides that the responsibility of museums to trace the history of ownership of a work is also that people just love bargains. And this wouldn't happen if people didn't think they were getting something good. And there's two types of bargain. One is the maybe Monet for a good price, or even the I'd have a copy now. The person who's commissioning all those Habsburg portraits for his house, in a way, he's getting a bargain, and that's what he likes. And he's getting a pretty recognizable bargain. And there's a point there that maybe instead of supporting some artist that doesn't have a distinctive style, he's buying some version of a distinctive style.
Question is whether you can fool all of the people all of the time. Let's take one of our callers. Aviza is on the line from Arlington, Massachusetts. Aviza, what would you like to contribute?
Hi. I'm currently working on a book on the reactions to art forgeries in the 19th century and a lot of the issues that you've been discussing today. And one of the things that struck me in my research and that I've been hearing today, too, is this strange contradiction between a kind of rejection of the fake art object as not true art or not true, not as valued as true original art, and a strange admiration of the figure of the forger. And I'm wondering how both the curators and John Myatt explain that tension between the kind of fascination with the figure of the forger and the rejection of his work.
Well, I think we have to go to John Myatt first. And John, I should add that there was actually a report that Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones are going to make a film based on you, The Great Forger.
Yeah, I heard that too. I don't know whether that's... There is an American film company from Hollywood, isn't it, who keep on emailing me and asking. So something's happening, but I just... I don't pay... You know, it's... Just,
you could actually give up your life of painting those paintings.
No,
but what
no.
do you think about this fascination? I read somewhere you've become a cult figure in Britain.
Well, I don't know. I mean, people write all kinds of strange things, don't they? Your lady in Arlington is, I think, what we've never really got round to saying is the M word, money. It's a lot of it is not about art. It's about money. If a painting by Van Gogh wasn't worth, good Lord, what did that Japanese bloke pay? $40 million or something? I mean, it's not just peculiar, it's disgusting. And I think if... that possibly, there's a sense in which all of us, rich, poor, or anywhere in between, would sort of think, well, this is silly. Look at paintings. You know, they don't keep you dry when it's wet. You can't eat them. Why on earth are they worth all this amount of money? And I think this answers the Arlington lady's question. Sorry, lady, I missed your name.
Aviza.
I think that is possibly why. There is something in all of us where we just sort of think, no, this is just ridiculous. And there's something rotten in the state of Denmark, as it were. And that coupled with a slight kind of wondering whether these experts actually, you know, since they do change their mind about attributions every 50 or 60 years, whether they really know what they're talking about, whether or not we ought to just say, look, I like that painting, I don't like that one, I don't need anybody to explain to me, to educate my eyes, I know what I like. Maybe in amongst all that, the money and a sense of unease about it, other people's expertise is why people think, well, here's somebody, a faker, a forger, you know, probably even a very nasty person in some cases. I mean, well, I'm mentioning no names, but some of them have been highly undesirable.
Well, let's put the M word back to Aviza. Does that explain a lot of it?
It does, but it's funny because, I mean, in my readings, what I've found is, and this is something that we mentioned that you mentioned at the beginning too, that the accusation tends to be placed on the art dealer, right? It's the story again of the poor, starving forger. I mean, this is again that we find a lot in these. Bastianini is another example of that, and you find this example of the poor forger who suddenly runs into a dishonest dealer, who then sells his works unknowingly. So often I find that the accusation, the whole money thing, gets placed on the dealer, and the forger still manages to be praised, at least in the 19th century, for his talent, for his creativity in certain cases, whereas the artworks have to be put in, you know, the museum, so-called the black museums, parts of the museum that are designated for fakes and forgeries.
Well, let's bring in some of these buyers and curators. Yeah. Alan Chong, do you feel hard done by?
You know, the story of fakes and forgeries is a very interesting one. It's in a sense they've always been there. I have a feeling that they're probably fake cave paintings somewhere. You know, painted a few years after the originals were done, and I think there is this continual delight in being able to fool experts. And as an art historian, I can only say that I agree with the two callers.
Have you been fooled?
Well, I think we all have been fooled to a certain extent, and we also set ourselves up as great big experts. And you're quite right. Every 50 years, we change our mind about Rembrandt or Raphael or Michelangelo in various ways. And I think we've overestimated the scientific scholarship of art historians and curators and, you know, experts. And that's part of the problem. Forgeries and the interest in fakes have been with us for hundreds of years. The idea of doing a movie is also a very old idea. Orson Welles made a movie for Faker, so that's nothing new either. The stories tend to repeat over and over again. I'm not so convinced about the money argument. I think there is a delight in creating something that is so intelligently crafted it might fool. That picks up on so many interesting cultural trends and psychological needs that this becomes a real forgery. And I think the great examples from the 19th century and early 20th century did not involve big amounts of money. It really involved the idea of passing something off.
You're giving us a rather delightful, fascinating picture of what happens behind those walls where the paintings are hanging so elegantly in the galleries. There's a battleground outside to see what is real and what is not. Frederick Ilchman.
Well, I think that Alan's got a very good point. It is in part the ultimate challenge. And in a way, we could consider art forgery the perfect crime. You know, it's a victimless crime, really. The only people that are victims are the wealthy and stupid. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that one advantage we have as museums is, to an extent, we have less of a financial stake. We're not a dealer or a collector. You know, I visited a collector's house a few years ago, and she had several purported old master paintings by a certain artist. And of the four, I thought two were by that artist. I didn't think either the other ones were fakes. They were rather works by the workshop. But clearly her labels all said that artist's name, and she, given the price she paid for them, was not going to change that. Whereas a museum quite often will put something down in the basement or up on the wall, and we can, depending on the label, we can, as long as we're making an educational point, we can in a way get away with a workshop or lesser work.
Well, we thank Aviza, who called us, a woman who's writing a book about fakes and forgeries. We'll take another caller, Jim, who's calling from Wakefield, Massachusetts. Jim, what would you like to say? Jim has gone away from us, unfortunately. So let's take another caller on the line from South Carolina, Archburg. Frank is with us. Frank.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning. What would you like to say about art or not so artistic art?
Well, I just wanted to say that I thought it was difficult to try and characterize even copies as art or not art because it depends on the individual work. And there's so many different reasons that people make copies. First of all, they're copies made for didactic purposes by artists who are trying to evolve their own styles, and there would be copies that are variations made by professionals who may enjoy something about the composition of a particular work and want to create their own variation of that theme, and then there would be copies with the intentions of the forger, which even in those instances may have some redeeming aspects, because like with the instance of John Myatt, where the artist is actually trying to destabilize the experts in this, the sense of having an idea of what an artist is capable of doing, of what fits into an artist's total oeuvre, without really always being completely based in fact. And so there are all these different motivations for the creation of the artwork will change our perception about that particular work. And so I think it's really impossible to determine in advance if a copy is not a work of art. I think it can be. And also, so many times the copies fool everyone, the experts and the public. I mean, I'm thinking of the forged Etruscan objects that were in the Getty and also in the Metropolitan Museum at different points. So if it's not art, why is the response to it so extraordinary? If it's just craftsmanship, it wouldn't make any sense. And I'm saying this from the basis of having run the copies program at the Metropolitan Museum for many years until 1990, I'm in a small museum in South Carolina now, but we had partnerships with the schools, with Parsons School of Design and Pratt Institute, where there were practicing artists who would come to look at old masterworks in order to learn something for their own development.
Well, Frank, thank you for that. I have to tell you, the two curators sitting with me have been nodding their heads almost the whole time, agreeing with you. Alan?
Oh, I agree totally. Copies can be made for lots of different reasons, and I'm, to a certain extent, also interested in how viewers and collectors and experts after that copy was made use that copy. Because in a way, I think Frederick made a very good point that John Heppner's early copy of The Blue Boy was misread in the late 19th century by a collector. And then there are middlemen and dealers who take what they want from copies. Each individual copy can be, or forgery can be considered on its independent merits, as it were. I mean, some contemporary artists copy works and make the act of copying a work of art in itself. And conceptually, I think that could work, although I'm certainly not a contemporary art expert.
Well, let's bring in John Myatt again, because I think he must have a last word. I have a last question for you, John. You've been quoted as saying that only 80 of the 200 paintings you did have been found, and you sometimes see them in auction catalogs. Do you ever think of coming clean on all of them?
Oh, no. Who was it who said victim? It was either Frederick or Alan said victimless crime. There's nothing to be gained by doing that. It just should be just stupid egotism if I went along and said, oh, I painted that. No.
But isn't it stupid egotism, to use your phrase, to let people continue to be fooled?
Well, they'd end up losing a lot of money, wouldn't they? The thing might have actually got well into the food chain by now. Let's suppose it's been sold three or four times since it was actually originally painted by me. No. I think it would actually, I know it sounds strange, but I think it would almost be unethical and immoral to do that. And as far as your lady in Arlington made this point about why forgers tend to be to sort of do quite well out of all this kind of thing in the public eye, I think it's something to do with the kind of Victorian pre-Raphaelite sort of idea of the romantic starving artist, the Trilby thing, you know, where everybody, all that kind of, and the public generally, artists generally are very badly paid, as a matter of fact. There's only 60 artists in this country, Britain, who actually earn enough money to pay income tax. I think I'm one of them. So you can see how bad things are. And I think the general public have a sense that, these people have a rough time of it anyway. The only good career move is death. That's a pretty sort of a pretty bad state of mind place to be, isn't it?
John, we're very glad that you made time for us. I think I'm going to get another last comment from our curators. Let them paint, Alan Chong.
Well, you know, a very easy way of making a fake is actually to claim you've made a fake rather than to paint one. And I'm wondering whether this, too, is a very old tradition that John just brought up, is to say, oh, there are many more of my fakes out there. You just don't know where they are. That's a pretty bad trick, too.
The mystery continues. Frederick Ilchin.
I'd just like to add in closing that the copy and the invented forgery has a lot to tell us about the original and why we consider the original important. The whole debate about originality says that art does matter. And, in fact, you know, the existence of copies makes the original more important. The Mona Lisa is famous because there's so many reproductions of it.
Oh, indeed. Who'd want a Mona Lisa on their wall? Thank you, Alan Chong. Thank you, Frederick Ilchin. Thank you, John Myatt, joining us from England. And thank you to all of our Connection listeners. Don't forget, you can continue the conversation on our website, www.theconnection.org. Is it really art when you're faking it? Thanks for joining in the conversation. I'm Lise Doucette, in for Dick Gordon on The Connection on NPR.